If you want to change your life, you first have to change your reality. In my first book, The Happiness Advantage, I describe the research on how a happy brain reaps a massive advantage in the workplace. I wrote about how, when we find and create happiness in our work, we show increased intelligence, creativity, and energy, improving nearly every single business and educational outcome. In short, that book was about how happiness comes before success. This book is about what comes before both. If you want to create positive change in your life, you first have to change your reality. To be honest, I think I've learned more about happiness over the past 5 years than I did in a decade sitting in labs and teaching in classrooms at Harvard. During this time, I've had the opportunity to travel to 51 countries, speaking at companies and schools, and learning more about this connection between success and happiness. But each place I visited pushed me harder. The more I observed, the more I wanted to understand how we can positively change people's view of the world to make them not just happier in the moment, but more engaged, more motivated, more alive, permanently. I wanted to learn how we could help people not just succeed at certain tasks or accomplish certain goals, but reach entirely new levels of success. But over the course of my travels, I also found that it wasn't enough to study success and happiness where it was easiest, in a controlled experiment with privileged university students as subjects. I wanted to test my theories where it was hardest. So to my mother's dismay, I was driven to lectures in Venezuela in bulletproof cars to speak with leaders under threats of express kidnappings about the research on resilience. I slept in huts in Tanzania surrounded by the biggest spiders I've ever seen, and I'm from Texas, so that's saying something, to hear from people who had been kicked off their land but who remained optimistic. I spoke about happiness at a public school assembly on the one-year anniversary of a mass shooting at the school. In a shanty town in Kenya, I met with illiterate mothers, one of whom was determined that her 8-year-old daughter would go to Harvard someday. I was the positive psychology expert for the Everyday Matters campaign to see if happiness remains a choice for individuals with a chronic neuromuscular disease. I worked with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the midst of an epidemic of depression, and Freddie Mac in the midst of a mortgage crisis. My company began working on an ambitious initiative at Walmart aimed at raising the happiness levels of their 1.5 million associates who are struggling to make ends meet in the face of complicated family and educational issues. Then I met with doctors attempting to cure terminal cancer in children at St. Jude and Boston Children's Hospitals to find out why sick 4-year-olds are more likely to tell their parents that everything will be okay than the reverse. At the other end of the spectrum, I was invited to work with Google and Facebook as they dealt with the confusing influx of wealth that was, ironically, sapping employees of their engagement and motivation. What did I learn? That for all my research about the connection between success and happiness, I had still been missing something important. Happiness led to success, true. But what gave someone, especially someone facing obstacles and hardships, the understanding that happiness was possible in the first place? Why did achievement and happiness seem like a possibility to one person, but impossible to someone else in the same position or situation? Why did some illiterate mothers believe their children could get into Harvard, while others couldn't fathom the idea? Why did some of the impoverished children in Indonesia create a happy playtime with only some sticks and string, while others sat bored and sullen? Why could missing out on a bonus inspire one leader at a UK financial services company to work better and harder, while causing another leader at the same company to give up and stop trying? Why did some people diagnosed with MS suddenly start training for marathons, while others remained mired in the belief that they'd never walk again?